Hello, folks, and welcome to The Farm, a podcast dedicated to culture, parapolitics, and high weirdness in all its many forms. This is your host, Recluse, aka Steven Snyder, the longtime curator of the Visa blog and author of A Special Relationship, Trump, Epstein, and the Secret History of the Anglo-American Establishment. As this is our subscriber section, I assume you guys know the drills now as far as websites go. All right, guys, I have got two guests appearing with me on the farm for this particular show. One of them a repeater, the other a noob. As to the latter, he is the host of a little podcast called Paranormal Patio, which I've recently appeared on. He's also a fellow high stringence aficionado, and he owns the coolest pairs of shoes these eyes have ever laid eyes upon. Seriously, you guys need to go to Strange Realities 2022 just to gasp these, just to take in these shoes, guys. Seriously, they are a wonder. Anyway, folks, I give you guys the great Jason Andrew and his fabulous shoes. Jason, thank you so much for dropping by tonight, sir.
My pleasure, man. Looking forward to it.
All right, our next guest is back for round three on the farm, and by popular demand, I know you guys have been digging the weird Wisconsin stuff he's been working on. He is the curator of The Weird Part, a blog and podcast dedicated to Fortean and paranormal phenomena, weird crime, and all kinds of other odd beliefs. Folks, I give you guys Vincent Treewell. Vincent, thank you so much for dropping by tonight, sir.
Oh, my pleasure, Stephen. Happy to be here.
So, this particular show is going to be a little different. It's a little more personal than what I normally go for on here, but rest assured, it'll be suitably weird, and I will talk about a few odd things happening right now that only a few people are really tracking. But on the whole, I wanted to focus on synchronicity in this show and how it's played into the lives of each individual who's appearing on here in some way. I picked these two gents for this particular show because we first encountered one another at the 2021 Strange Realities Con in Nashville, Tennessee this year, and subsequently I've had some other separate encounters with both guys. Obviously, Jason and Vincent are more concerned with paranormal affairs than myself, but all of us have been drawn into investigations involving occultists linked to Kenneth Grant and dealing with invocations of Lovecraftian entities. Obviously, this isn't the type of thing people normally bond over, but here we are. But in all seriousness, though, it's kind of crazy, the paths that we've taken here. And I thought it might be kind of fun to untangle a bit of this, because we all know the world's crazy right now, and it's uncertain. There's a lot to worry about, some of it warranted, some of it not so much. Regardless, there's plenty to go around. What is lacking is wonder. And that's a pity, because big things are happening on that front as well. The great Christopher Knowles of The Secret Sun talks about re-enchantment, and he's absolutely right. Reality isn't what it used to be, and with this outing, we're going to recount our own experiences with re-enchantment. But before delving in, let me lay some backdrop. The Cybernetic Cultural Research Unit, or CCRU, the great advocates of accelerationism and hyperstition, believe that the world really did end with Y2K. Certainly, it seems like things have never really been quite the same since 2000. There are obvious geopolitical reasons for this. The 2000 election fiasco, 9/11, the Afghan and Iraq wars, the 2008 financial crisis, and the ensuing decline of the American empire, among other highlights. Not only have these things broken public trust in virtually all institutions, but they've also induced a prolonged sense of trauma in not only the American public, but much of the world's population. It's fashionable to compare the times that we live in with the climate that produced both Gnosticism and the modern incarnation of Christianity as the Hellenistic world fell and the Roman Republic transformed into an empire. I won't quibble with this argument, but at this stage, at least, it seems like we're heading towards the former rather than the latter in the current climate of crisis. Interestingly, many of my crucial experiences with high weirdness coincided with major political upheavals. I've told this story a lot by now, but for the one of you two of you who haven't heard it, the first really woo-woo experience I had coincided with the first time I had taken magic mushrooms. So I was living at the dorms at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs at the time, which would be about 2003, maybe 2004-ish. This was right as the Iraq War was really heating up, and Colorado Springs is a big military city. The NORAD headquarters is there, along with the Army and Air Force bases. It's also still the national headquarters for Focus on the Family, James Dobson, his whole crowd. It was a very intense atmosphere at the time, to put it mildly. Lots of people going to the school had family and friends there. So anyway, against this backdrop, I take the shrooms. And it was a pretty standard, you know, trip as far as it goes up to that point in time. And then this would have been, you know, kind of getting into the witching hour. I wandered into the cafeteria. The dorms did this late night meal thing for the kids. It was really nice. You could get this breakfast kind of stuff there and a few other things. Anyway, I walk in to the cafeteria area. Like most cafeterias, it has a rather white decor. But this time around, it seems like it's absolutely engulfed in smoke or smog or something like that, like an arena rock show with the smog machine going full blast. And as I get into kind of the area where the food is, I see these gray aliens wandering around among the students. I mean, at least, you know, 7 feet tall, that kind of thing. Now, I've done a lot of psychedelics, and I've never seen anything like this before or since. Well, I hadn't really tripped before then, so that's a bit of a... This wasn't really just the first time I did magic mushrooms. It was really the first time I had tripped in general. And yeah, I have never gotten those kinds of intense visuals of some kind of entity like that ever since. So anyway, this led me to a fascination with the notion that people had had encounters with non-human intelligences while in altered states. So another thing that I started to explore, in addition to psychedelic encounters that people had had with gray aliens and things like that, were the SRI remote viewing experiments. I kind of bridged the gap from those after looking at the Strassman DMT experiments that I think the University of Arizona, it might have been New Mexico, did in the 90s. A lot of people on DMT had recounted experiences of you know, kind of gray aliens and that, which sort of also brings up McKenna's whole concept of the mechanical elves and so forth. And I think from there with the Strassman stuff was how I had stumbled on the SRI remote viewing experiments. Again, some of the remote viewers had also witnessed gray aliens, or just aliens in general, while they were doing the remote viewing. And anyway, after looking at the SRI experiments, that's where I kind of picked up on MKUltra and Artichoke. And that's what really got me into exploring parapolitics, bringing things full circle in a way. So anyway, the next big thing for me was starting up VizUp, okay, my blog. This would have been in 2010 as the long recession was still unfolding. Occupy and the Arab Springs were starting to break out. VizUp was started as a ghost hunting outfit, however. A lot of people don't know that. It actually stands for Volusia Investigative Society of Unexplained Phenomena. At the onset, my partner and I spent a lot of time in Casadega, Florida, doing some investigations there. Now, for those of you unaware, Casadega was founded by the Spiritualist Church around the turn of the 20th century. Supposedly, the location was chosen by spirit guides. It's still controlled by the church to this day, though it has more of a New Age vibe to it now. But the park there, Lake Colby Park, is just amazing. Now, the original Casadega Hotel was actually built in the lands that Lake Colby Park currently inhabits. It was burned down sometime around the 1920s, and I've always been curious as to why, but there's just not a lot of information there on the circumstances surrounding it. There are a lot of very strange ruins from the hotel out there, though. Inevitably, a lot of occult groups practice rites out there, and it's easy to see why. It's also an eerie place. I tend to think that it was some kind of window area, which is why the original hotel was built there. A lot of people have reported having otherworldly encounters there, including yours truly. You cannot camp at Lake Kobe Park, but my profane youth, myself and two other friends had snuck one there and spent the night at the park. It was quite an experience, and we had one point started to wander up to the area where the hotel had originally stood, and there's these groves there, these kind of bamboo groves. We were going to this particular spot because we had already had some kind of strange experiences there before, and we had set up our campsite deeper in the park. This particular area wasn't too far from the road, so we had thought it would be better to get a little bit away from the main road in case somebody wandered by and wouldn't be able to see the fire. So anyway, the whole time, you know, we had been walking up to the groves, it seemed like there was wrestling in the treetops, as though something was kind of like lumbering and swinging around from tree to tree, following us. It was very strange, and there was also the inevitable feeling of being watched. So anyway, we get to the groves, and then suddenly you see just this great force coming through the trees, like something had been shot out of a cannon or something at us. My buddies fled. I stood my ground, and I felt just this force come up to my face and then pull up at the last minute. We had filmed some of it, and upon looking at it, you could see an orb on the video. Yeah, it was pretty interesting, to put it mildly. But of course, that's not the only thing that's interesting about Casadega, not by a long shot. See, it's also only a few miles from a place called DeLand, Florida. Now, this is where H.R. Barlow resided as a teenager. Barlow was an uber of Lovecraft fan, as I'm sure many of you are aware. He became an executioner of Lovecraft's estate after Lovecraft shit his mortal coil in 1937. Barlow had corresponded with Lovecraft since he was 13, and the famed weird fiction author had visited Barlow in DeLand on occasion while he was a teenager. Apparently, they shared a shed together separate from the family's home that Barlow's father had built, apparently, for Lovecraft's visits. Anyway, it was in this shed that Barlow, in his teenage years, and Lovecraft, as a middle-aged adult, spoke of literature together deep into the night. Right. Barlow eventually committed suicide in 1952 at the age of 32. He had an interesting life up to that point, though. Besides his peculiar friendship, quote-unquote, with Lovecraft, he later became an anthropologist, and he became a fellow of the Rockefeller Foundation in the post-war years, at a time when the Rockefellers were lavishing funds on anthropology and other social sciences for the purposes of counterinsurgency and pacification in the developing world. Barlow had already relocated to Mexico, and Latin America was a particular obsession for the Rockefeller family in that regard. So Barlow taught at Mexico City University at the time of his suicide. One of his students was William S. Burroughs. Burroughs is the famed beat writer who conceived of the 23 Enigma, which Robert Anton Wilson later popularized. I'm sure many of you are aware I'm obsessed with 23, which I picked up from Raw. I had no idea of any of these connections at the time. I was only just discovering Raw when I started going to Casadega. I should probably note I had also just begun to explore the synchromystical scene at the same time as well, which is why I kind of became bored with ghost hunting pretty quickly. Now, in the midst of the writing process of what will probably be a 200,000 word book on Discordianism, the weaponization of social sciences for the purposes of counterinsurgency, and the use of high strangeness and gallows humor for psychological warfare, I think things have come full circle. I'll explain that now. So this book came in relation to the circumstances that began to unfold in late 2019 and early 2020. It was then that I first discovered the show Hellier, which in turn is how I became involved with the Pennyroyal crew. I first encountered Nathan in February 2020, just before the COVID lockdowns occurred. And then the whole thing was really interesting too. Nathan's whole thing in the second season of Hellier had really resonated with me. So I had wanted to contact him. I had tried messaging him through Facebook, I think in late January, and had never heard anything back from him. And then about a month later, I got an email from him, and he had wanted to interview me for Pennyroyal. This was just around the time I had actually started doing the farm. Ironically, the farm was launched in November 2019 on November 11th. That's an 11-11 for you guys, which is interesting in light of how big 11-11 is with the whole investigation I've gone into Q. So another kind of interesting sync with the way my life is gone in the last couple of years. But anyway, back to Nathan. Nathan had wanted to interview me for Pennyroyal, and I had wanted to interview him for the farm. And so that kind of worked out. But it was interesting that we had both kind of come to this conclusion around the same time, and we're both trying to contact each other. Nathan, of course, was not aware that I had earlier messaged him on Facebook. So yeah, the whole thing was pretty interesting. So my first trip to Somerset occurred in June 2020, right when the lockdowns were really going into full effect. Okay, so I later returned in October 2020 for the premiere party. It was during that time I first encountered those mysterious documents the Pennyroyal guys have been exploring in their second season. They allegedly contain copies of the Golden Lily certificates. Which, you know, again, is something I had written quite heavily about on my blog. And within those documents, my blog was even mentioned. trying to explain these things inadvertently became a crucial part of the book I'm working on, and Discordianism and all that other good stuff. And then, of course, that's to say nothing of all the Discordianism that's surrounding Somerset and some of the related characters there. But, it's time for another discussion. So anyway, in the same time frame, I've experienced the same amount of synchronicities and high strangeness, to say nothing of the incredible people I've encountered. And increasingly, it doesn't seem like I'm the only one who's been on such a journey in the 21st century, and especially in the last few years. All right, I have blathered enough. I'm going to open the floor up to my guests, and finally, because I think there may be a little bit of overlap here. So let's see how this goes. Okay, Jason, you're up first. Tell us about how you got into high strangeness.
So I like to say that I am a member of the Ghostbusters generation. I was born in 1985, so I've never known a world without Ghostbusters. And it definitely was instrumental in my formative years, you know, growing up watching the real Ghostbusters cartoon and both of the movies. So that really sort of kicked things off for me as a child, and it stuck with me, you know, through my whole life. Of course, it goes in and out, you know, as things do, hobbies and interests and, you know, just the way things go. Started taking things a lot more seriously with a much more eclectic and mature point of view after watching Hellier a couple of years ago and going down my own synchronistic journey. That brought me here to the farm.
That's really interesting about Ghostbusters. Certainly, I grew up with that too. I was born in 1982. So yeah, like you, I pretty much always was in a world with Ghostbusters. But you know, the other weird thing about that, there's a very strong possibility it was partly influenced by that whole circle around the magical child in New York City in the 1970s that Peter Lavenda was a part of, in which the Simon Necronomicon came out of. You see, Dan Aykroyd was actually a patron of the magical child at times, and it's quite possible that some of the elaborate Sumerian mythology that was incorporated into the first Ghostbusters movie was partly inspired by the Simon Necronomicon. So it's kind of interesting how, like, even when we sort of like look back on some of those like cultural influences as kids, you sort of have that specter of this this peculiar Lovecraftian gnosis sort of hovering in the background of it. But yeah, it is interesting to kind of think about how many kids of our generation, you know, were sort of influenced by that whole milieu indirectly through Ghostbusters. I mean, certainly I was, and apparently you were too, quite heavily.
Oh yeah, yeah, for sure. I was actually really lucky enough. One of my earliest Patreon exclusive live streams. We do one every month. One of them was I had a couple of psychics come to the studio, and one of them is Scotty Rorick from Wisconsin, and he has like an ectomobile. He didn't drive it here, which I was really disappointed in, but he owns one, and he's super Ghostbusters influence. Like he has, you know, the whole jumpsuit and proton pack and the whole bit, which is really fun.
Does he have actually heard of that guy? Yes.
Oh, does he have like one of the books? What is it? Tobin's Spirit Guide and like the, oh gosh, the one that they always would cite, like in the, I think it was the movie first and then later the cartoon.
Yeah, Tobin's Spirit Guide is definitely the Ghostbusters thing. I don't know of Scotty having any sort of connection to that, but.
All right, Vincent. So how about you, sir?
Well, I'm a bit older than you fellows, but I was first drawn into interest in the paranormal probably with In Search Of, with Leonard Nimoy. And that came from my childhood to my youth that was on. And that was a huge influence on me. And just loved In Search Of, have seen all the episodes. And read, you know, a lot of the books that were available at that time. Things like Invisible Horizons and that whole genre. And then as an adult, Paranoia Magazine was a big influence on me. That really, I started to see the parapolitical, and I started to see when they connected, and I can't remember the author, but I remember the article, UFOs and religious apparitions. That was a mind blower for me. And like, whoa, hey, there's a lot more to this than just finding, you know, the saucer parts or capturing the flesh and blood Bigfoot. This is a real, there's a whole lot more going on behind the scenes. And I got into a magazine from Britain called Fortean Times. And that is top of the line. I'm a subscriber now. And I've been reading it for about 15 years. And it really does good coverage of very weird topics, being neither debunkers nor just gullible. They really, sometimes they take them apart and find fakes. Sometimes they find some stuff that's impossible to explain by normal means. And they do the background that's the real work, you know. And then the movie Mothman Prophecies came out. And it's an okay movie. I mean, it's a good movie. It's worth your time. But maybe 5% of that is what's in the book. And I read the book and it blew my mind. And that's how I ended up in this world and how I am here now. I blame John Keel. Yes. So yeah, that's kind of how I got here.
Yeah, no, he would definitely be high on the list for myself as well. I tended to gravitate a little more towards Robert Anton Wilson, but yeah, as now I'm a West Virginian, so Keel has always had a bit of a special place in my heart, certainly. And good calling on Search Of with Leonard Nimoy too, Vincent. It was a little after my time, or before my time, rather, but I did go back and I rewatched it, and yes, it was just something to the 70s version of it, certain air of mystery and so forth. I suppose you could say a lot about the Mothman movie, too. I mean, like you said, it doesn't really have, I mean, a lot in common with the book, but it's just, I don't know, it kind of captures the atmosphere of it in a way. I don't know. It's hard to explain. It's a movie that's much more the sum of, it's greater than the sum of its parts, certainly. All right, so let's talk a little turbulence here. Were these volatile times for society at large or for you guys personally when you guys started to develop these interests? So why don't you start us off this time, Vincent?
Well, I wouldn't say I was so much drawn to the paranormal I was already there by the time, say, Y2K was happening, or not happening. I had read what you said earlier, and I have had that, and I'm speculating like everybody else, you know, I don't have any answers here, but I've had that just gut feeling that the world did kind of split at Y2K, that when people are talking about the Mandela effect and things like that, I've kind of wondered if Y2K wasn't like a kind of a Schrodinger's cat moment for the whole world. That either it happens and there's big computer failures and society ends and everything collapses, or not much happens at all and we're here now. And it seems like something did happen then, but I was more involved with the practical side of that, and people were losing their minds at that time. And I personally interacted with a guy named Jeffrey L. Moss, who I've mentioned in a previous podcast, and he was certainly not alone, but he's just the one I remember the most, that I was working in law enforcement at that time, and I was in Milwaukee working in the jail. And he was there for stealing all these religious statues out of churches, because right around Y2K, there's going to be a comet that hits the earth, and the communists are going to take over and destroy all the religious statues. So he saved them in this shed not far at all from the Nisida Shrine, and he was caught and ended up spending some time in jail, and eventually they realized that this was a problem. He was not a criminal looking for valuables. It was completely in his mind, and he ended up doing some probation and basically being released. But yeah, people were losing their minds over what might happen. And I remember that very strongly. I wasn't even worried about the computers. We have IT problems all the time. We can fix that. I was worried that society was expecting something to happen. And if something happens, even if it's a false flag, even if it's not remotely as important as it appears, it could trigger, you know, some real upheaval and chaos in a very bad way. And so I was nervous as hell about Y2K. And then, at least in our world, everything worked out. But people were expecting a hell of a lot around the 1999 era time. I always loved the TV show Millennium.
It's one of my favorites here. I did a show with Chris Knowles on that, but yes, you're in good company with that one, Vincent.
Yes, that's like an all-time favorite. I have it on DVD. It's better than The X-Files, and I don't say that lightly. Okay, but it's, to me, significantly better. And
I could definitely see that, sir.
You know, and everybody was looking for something to happen. The millennial angst was going on. And I always kept it in the back of my mind that the millennium didn't really end at the end of 1999. It ends at the end of 2000. And if you go by the Julian calendar, then New Year's, the beginning of the millennium, ends up being somewhere around April 1st of 2001. Well, then that's only like shortly over 5 months before 9/11. And I really remember the swirl of fear, because 9/11 didn't happen in a vacuum. The anthrax letters were coming at that same time. And the Beltway snipers,
yeah,
were killing people, and nobody had not been caught. And in the midst of all this, then this huge thing happens. And it was like, I absolutely believe that there were people in high positions who were turning up the heat to boil the American group mind, you know, to get society on edge and to get us in a very fierce, you know, overwhelmed with fear and very paranoid, and then not questioning what false flags might come. And you'll never prove any of this stuff, but I know that there was manipulation on all three of those events. No one can tell me that there wasn't. And it wasn't the same, and that it wasn't the same people manipulating those events and others to create a climate that was good for their interests. So yeah, those are my memories. Go ahead.
Yeah,
Yeah, no, it was and I mean it was definitely an interesting with the run up to Y2K too, because I mean it was, you know, you had a lot of those high profile cults specifically that had really inspired the series Millennial, the Order of the Solar Temple. I did a show with Chris Knowles on that too, and Heaven's Gate, and certainly, you know, you had a couple of those mass suicides. This was all, of course, coming in the backdrop of the Waco siege. And, you know, I mean, it was definitely a lot of fanaticism that was going on in America in the 90s. So even as a teenager, I mean, I was definitely aware of that. So I can definitely see where you're coming from, Vincent. But yeah, and then you sort of had this just total anticlimactic thing with when Y2K actually happened. But then, you know, about what, 11 months later, you know, you have the 2000 election, which was another, you know, major issue. I mean, that's, it almost sort of, I mean, again, is a parallel to some extent to the 2016 election, where they were both sort of, I guess, in the aftermath, people argued that that was almost a kind of glitch in the matrix, or an instance of the Mandela effect, where the candidate who was supposed to win end up didn't inexplicably, and it really reversed the course of history in a way. Who knows? But I mean, I can kind of see certainly the parallels with the Bush 2 and the Trump presidencies, and how they certainly nudged the country in possibly more unexpected directions than what the other candidates would have taken it in. But yeah, and then obviously from there we got 9/11, we got the anthrax thing, we got the DC sniper. I mean, it was just very much a fear of paranoia and dread, sort of like what we were all expecting to happen with some of the extremists, you know, leading up to Y2K, but in a very different guise. So yeah, it's a very perceptive. So out of curiosity, were you just though, you weren't really like paying too much attention to high strangeness at the time though, Vincent, were you?
I was. I had already been exposed to Paranoia Magazine and to, his name escapes me now, but Conspiracies, Covers Up, and Crimes, and Jonathan Vonkin. Yeah. So yes, I was very much in a conspiracy mindset, in a parapolitics mindset. And I remember as everybody was kind of a flutter in the last week of 1999, telling my wife, well, for about a week now, everybody's living in my world. So yes, I'm like this all the time. Yes. So yeah, I was expecting a lot more than what happened, but that was just the calm before the storm.
Yeah, it certainly was. All right, Jason, you're up, sir. How about you?
So I was 15. And I basically was just riding the roller coaster of teenage hormones, you know, at the time. I was working at a local gas station leading up to 9/11. And actually, yeah, I was there for Y2K as well, because I take offense to the anticlimactic thing, because our payphone stopped working at the gas station. So there were some serious ramifications of this Y2K bug. Don't want that to be overlooked. But, you know, a one-stop white town in East Central Illinois loses its sole payphone and the world just explodes shortly thereafter. The current events at the time, you know, everything from leading up to Y2K and then up to September 11th was, it seems like it was just like the prologue. Like looking back, like this is how the rest of your life is going to be. You know, I've kind of always felt like, I don't know, I've been on borrowed time since I was, you know, a teenager, just because of how the world has shifted so dramatically. And with those shifts, there are definitely different focuses that you find yourself looking into, high strangeness being one of them. With the pandemic, that's what started, you know, my show being in the podcast world. And because of that, I've been opened up to a lot of different stories and a lot of different people and their experiences. And I've grown a lot in the last 2 years, just with my knowledge of all of these different crazy things that I never would have even known existed prior. So not all change is, you know, necessarily easy or good, but I think you can always find something to emerge as when you come out of the cocoon, you know, with the thunderstorms blowing and the world on fire and everything's either flooded or drought and we just keep sucking oil out of the ground. But yeah, it's weird. It's really weird. What a time to become an adult, you know, that's how I look at it. What a time to come into your own. In 2000, 2001, it was insane, really insane.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely interesting. And I mean, I don't know that any of us, well, I mean, I'm sure there were some people, but I mean, it was almost like we were kind of entering into a perpetual state of high strangeness in the aftermath of Y2K. Because I mean, you know, we experienced, you know, the 2000 elections and 9/11 and I mean, all the ensuing events. And I think for the longest time, I mean, everybody kind of thought that this was an abnormality and we were going to go back to normalcy here at some point. And, you know, we would kind of get back to that kind of, you know, nice soft spot that we were in the 90s or whatever, maybe the 70s. I mean, who knows? But, you know, it never happened. I mean, it was just kind of like one series of stage of crises after another. So yeah, and I mean, with it, it's just it's brought chaos, I mean, to so many people on so many levels. And I do think it's kind of reflected on just the general weirdness that's come out of all of it, because I mean, the world just has gotten very weird because of these perpetual events.
You know, except for my most recent experience with the, I'm going to get woo-woo here, with, you know, a ghost, which I think we talked about. Every other instance of me interacting or being interacted with some sort of, you know, spiritual manifestation came in that time period. Like from the time I was 16 until the time I was probably 20. So 2001 to 2005. I think that's the bulk of the things that I had, like seeing apparitions and being touched and things like that. That all came from that time period. Now that you mentioned that, it's just kind of hit me that that's all when all of that happened.
Yeah, it is interesting. I know for me, like, as of course, I got into how Vizip had started as a paranormal investigation thing, and it was more like around the time of the Wall Street financial crisis and kind of the ensuing aftermath and a lot of the events around that, like the Arab Springs and Occupy. And I remember at the time, you know, this was when I was really heavy into that. And certainly most of my paranormal experiences also unfolded during that time frame as well. But yeah, that's kind of something that I'm very curious about with all of this. Vincent, out of curiosity, did you have any particular like a series of paranormal events or anything like that that were kind of linked to some of these periods of particular chaos in the broader world?
It's funny because the most intense personal experiences that I've had actually happened in 2019. And there were...
I'll do it.
There were two that were at a whole nother level than I'd ever experienced. Okay, I didn't really consider myself to be an experiencer, you know. I had never seen it. I have never seen a UFO. I had never seen, you know, I didn't really have experiences like that. Now, I'd had some things happen, as I think almost everybody has. But that the year right before the pandemic began, so from May of 2019 to either the end of 2019, very early beginning of 2020, I had two unique experiences. I had a cryptid sighting in May of 2019. And it was, my wife and I were in Richland County, Wisconsin to visit my grandmother. And as we were driving down the road, out of a cornfield came this creature. And it ran what I would estimate to be about 100 yards up a hill. It's a very hilly country, and into a wooded area. And we saw it for, I'd say, about 5 seconds. But enough time, it wasn't peripheral vision. It was a good, clear look at something. And right at, like, once we got into town and we had a chance to talk, I asked my wife, "So what did you see?" And she said, "I saw Bigfoot. What'd you see?" And I said, "Well, I didn't see Bigfoot. I saw a bear. But I saw a huge, gigantic bear, like a bear that is way too big to be real. Especially bears don't even live in that area. And the ones that live in Wisconsin at all are like black bears that, you know, are maybe 300 pounds if they're big. This thing was like the size of a small car and just enormous. Also, bears are like all one color. They could be different colors, but one bear won't be striped. And this bear was multicolored. And it was just hauling ass out of the cornfield and across this open area and into the woods and gone. And what she saw, she described completely as Bigfoot, as Sasquatch, and described as looking kind of like the orangutan character in the current Planet of the Apes series, and being also multicolored, being, you know, having like blonde and red fur, but being a primate and definitely an ape-like creature. And, you know, that's what she saw. And we saw something, but it was very, you know, I'd never had a sighting like that remotely ever. And that happened in May of 2019. Then about 6 months later, I had a dental problem. I broke a tooth and I get my health care through the VA. So I asked my wife to drive me to the VA hospital, and because I thought they might sedate me. And my son came along and he's in his teens, and we went to the VA hospital. They dropped me off. They went on to Walmart. They get to Walmart and they saw my doppelganger. They saw me, and, you know, I'm at no time sedated. I'm just sitting in a waiting room. They gave me a prescription and said, come back on Monday. But they saw a guy who looked exactly like me, and to the point where, having just dropped me off a few minutes earlier, they thought it was me, and they discussed whether they should like approach this person and ask, what am I doing here when I'm supposed to be at the hospital? And I asked, well, you know, did he talk? And my son was kind of shaking. He's like, he did talk, but he sounded just like you. And I'm like, well, you know how I was dressed. Yeah, he was dressed that way too. And I was like, what was maybe the most disturbing part, he wasn't there alone. He was there with a different wife and kids who were nothing like my wife and kids. And it was just a absolutely bizarre encounter. I mean, this was so dead on that it was not a guy who looked vaguely like me. It was just like me and talked like me and dressed like me, and yet was there with somebody else. And it was absolutely one of the weirdest things that's ever happened to me. So yeah, those things didn't happen to me on any kind of regular basis until the 2019 era, right then.
You know, and it's interesting too. I mean, I can't really get into this too much, but there are definitely people that I know I'm very close to who, you know, I mean, I've also had kind of a history of a lot of high strangeness, but I mean, specifically 2019 was kind of a banner year. I mean, I know for myself, I had a couple of instances. I mean, I'd seen a UFO that year and a few other things, but I mean, yeah, it was definitely, it seems like for a certain kind of person, 2019, sort of in that lead up to the lockdowns, I mean, you know, we were getting certain vibes, I think, kind of in the run up to it and COVID and all that good stuff. But yeah, 2019 and 2017 also were kind of interesting years for, I think, a lot of people leading up to, I think 2017 was maybe more of a reverberation of sort of the elections and the shock of what had happened with that. And then I think 2019, though, was just sort of that tension that, I mean, some people were picking up on leading up to the lockdowns and the COVID pandemic and all this other insanity that we've all been dealing with now for the past 2 years. Oh, well, certainly interesting times there. All right, so let's get into the Strange Realities Con, which we all attended in Nashville in the past year here. So I want to know what brought you guys to the 2021 manifestation. So why don't you start us off, Vincent?
Well, I knew I had to get there. It was just, I'd gone from listening to podcasts that were like Serial on NPR to realizing there's a whole world of people who didn't have a 28-person staff to write and produce and edit and all that, and were just doing it. And that really blew my mind, because I'd gone from, wow, that'd be really great, I'd love to have a podcast, but I could never, you know, what am I supposed to burn some CDs and mail them to NPR? I don't know how to do any of this stuff, you know? And then I think the first one I started listening to was Where Did the Road Go with Soraya Ascoth. And I'm like, pow, this guy's just doing it. He's just like, okay. He doesn't have a staff that like prepares the stuff. He just does it. And then I found other people who were doing it, and I found you were doing it, and I'm like, okay, maybe, possibly, I could do something like this. And it was really inspiring, and I said, no, I need to get there. This is a gathering of my people, and I need to be there. And for the first time in a hell of a long time, I actually was in a room where I just vibed with everybody there. And it was great. I'm going to make a little bit of a Gen X reference that I don't know if you'll get or not. But the 90s band Blind Melon had a song, now it escapes me, but they only had like one big hit, so it's probably that one, where this little girl is dressed as a bumblebee and she's performing in this, I don't know, school play or something, and she gets booed and she leaves in tears and she goes around the city, and then she opens this gate and goes in, and there's like 36 people dressed as bumblebees. And that's what it was like going to Strange Realities. It's like you're in this world where you don't really get to talk about this stuff that much, and sometimes you may want to limit how much you talk about this stuff for many reasons. And then you get there and you can just really pour it out with everybody there. And it was great. It was one of the better experiences of my life. So I'm coming back this year, no doubt.
And you'll get to see Jason's shoes, man. Not alone.
I've heard they're pretty great.
I have too. I've heard it from a lot of people.
All right. So what brought you to Strange Realities 2021, man?
So, I mean, I could sit here and just regurgitate the last part of what Vincent said. That sense of community around these ideas and these ways of thinking, I don't have that in my regular everyday life. There are a few people who are, you know, moderately interested in this stuff, but no one is as invested in it as I have become. And it gets to be really, I don't know, like lonely-ish. Like, it's not good for your mental health when something that's such a big part of your life isn't shareable with the people in your life, you know, which is why the podcast services a need for me, because I can bring someone on and we can talk about some weird stuff. And then, you know, I can put it out for other people who don't have that outlet for themselves, and they can listen to it and be like, okay, now I have this. And it's like I'm hearing this conversation. It's like I'm a part of the conversation. And I kind of fell into that with Conspiranormal, just finding the podcast and listening to it. And then then seeing the lineup that it was going to be, you know, and how I had to go see Alan Greenfield. I mean, he's getting up there in age, you know, and who knows how many more of these type of things he'll be able to do. And I'm certainly not planning on going to Atlanta anytime soon. So I definitely wanted to, you know, meet Alan and support a lot of really well-spoken and intelligent people who are also interested in, you know, the strange and the weird and the bizarre and the conspiratorial and all the fun stuff that I like to spend my time on. And just like Vincent said, it's just being in the room full of people in bee suits. Like, there's absolutely no substitution for an experience like that in your life, even if it's not paranormal stuff and weird stuff. Like, if you can find that group of people who are into everything that you're into, like, those are your people. And you'll never feel more at home anywhere else than with your own people. And that definitely was what Strange Realities 2021 was for me.
It's an interesting thing about the COVID pandemic and the lockdowns, because, I mean, I do think one of the more beneficial aspects of it, the kind of silver lining and all the darkness, was that it did strengthen and even create more of these kind of alternative communities. I mean, you started to see a lot of this stuff becoming, I think, more personal for a lot of people with, like, kind of the Zoom parties and stuff like that. I mean, of course, this Conspiranormal guys do that monthly for their subscribers. It's a great thing. Certainly it's something you guys might want to look into if you haven't already with them. But yeah, and it's really great to see how in general it kind of seems like now that the lockdowns are lifting, people are continuing to take these communities to the next step. And, you know, we're all kind of starting to meet up in real life and what have you. I mean, certainly I've made a really concerted effort in the last 2 years to start traveling more and, you know, meeting up with some of these people, even amidst the pandemic. And it kind of sounds like some other people have as well. So yeah, I think this is going to be, you know, one of the more beneficial aspects that's going to come out of this, because I think a lot of people, you know, they're kind of finally starting to find their tribe, so to speak. And, you know, that's important. Everybody needs to feel like they're a part of something ultimately. And like you're saying, I mean, having a community, being able to talk with each other, like both of you are saying, I mean, that's it's a fundamental aspect of being a functioning human being. All right. So, Jason, and you and I have had some odd personal synchronicities since the Strange Realities Con. So tell us about the weird hotel thing in Somerset and any other oddities you might have noticed.
So every time that I've been to Somerset, and I think I even might have called up Nathan Isaac and told him when I first got there that I expected there to be like a line of cultists across the road, you know, blocking my path in robes with scythes and swords and, you know, all this crazy stuff. you know, and of course that's not what you get. And you get there and there's this weird mix of mysterious and beautiful and exciting energy. But it's all relaxed. It's weird. You know, Somerset is a bizarre place. But I've enjoyed every moment that I've been there for sure. And all of the people that are in like this weirdo circle that happen to be in Somerset are the nicest people I have ever met anywhere, absolutely anywhere. And you really feel like you're at home around these people, even though you barely know them, or, you know, maybe you kind of know them. But yeah, the hotel thing was, that was pretty strange, man. So we're at the Penny Royal season 2 release party, and you would think Somerset should have an Uber service or a Lyft service or something, taxi at least. And you were a little worried about getting back to the hotel after the party, which, you know, commendable. You know, you got to respect not driving under the influence. And yeah, end of the night, I'm getting ready to leave. And you're like, hey, do you think there's any chance you could give me a ride to my hotel? And I'm like, yeah, no problem. You know, I'm at X hotel. And you're like, oh, I'm at X hotel. And we had another guy with us, and he was just down the road, like maybe a block, right? But so we pull up to our hotel.
Oh, I just got to interject here. You know, for you Penny Royal listeners, the guy with us was actually the one that gave Nate and Kyle and Darren and myself the documents that they've been talking so much about in season two. So there was that kind of air of mystery too. Those were the three guys in the car.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't
I'm
know
sorry to interrupt. Just when your name came up in those damn documents, that blew my mind. Okay, so I'm sure it was pretty shocking for you too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That was like a you know another one of the strange things that's happened to me in the last 2 years or so. But yeah, this whole thing with the copies of the Golden Lily certificates and kind of the dossier, which my website was like mentioned in, and yeah, yeah, yeah. It was pretty crazy.
I wasn't sure if I could address who the third person was, like if it would be cool or not. So I didn't.
We'll just leave it at that. The source of the documents. We don't want to like give too much away about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, so we roll up to our hotel and, you know, we walk in, we walk up to the elevator and I don't know who asked you, but like, you know, what floor are you on? And, you know, two. And then we emerge from the elevator and realize that we have been staying like side by side, like our rooms are neighboring rooms in this kind of weird hotel. And it was really interesting. You're like, oh yeah, you're the do not disturb guy. And I'm like, yes, I am.
Because I think I was like, it had my do not disturb sign out like the entire time too. So you're like walking down like this kind of like line of like, you know, hotel rooms. And there's like the two hotel rooms right next to each other with like the perpetual do not disturb signs.
What are the odds though? I mean, you know, it's really weird that, you know, we show up in town from different parts of the country to go to the same event and we just happen to be staying at the same hotel, which is, you know, not necessarily connected to the event in any way. It was kind of weird. And then, you know, for me to give you a ride back just to find all that out, you know, it was fun. Kind
of a whole series of events. And then of course, obviously previously we've been at the Strange Realities thing and it was definitely interesting.
Yeah, I didn't even know that you were going to be in Somerset that night. So yeah, it was until I saw you earlier that day at the museum, Eck House Museum. I didn't know that you were planning on coming down. So it was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah, yeah, no, it was definitely fun times. All right, Vincent, you and I had some interesting synchronicities as well, most notably about Kenneth Grant. One of the things I've helped the Penny Royal crew research is Kenneth Grant and specifically the Bait Cabal. Nathan discovered that the Cincinnati-based outfit was performing rituals to summon Lovecraftian old ones in Somerset area during the 1970s. Now, this was one of several occult circles involved in these types of rituals Grant was corresponding with during the glorious 1970s, the weird 1970s. So in the midst of our first podcast together, Vincent, within the Cetus Shrine, we realized that a group of cultists centered around the works of Michael Bertrio and in contact with Grant were performing similar rituals in the Devil's Lake region. Did that put the area in a different perspective for you, sir?
Oh, yes. That really was a game changer. It was way weirder than I expected. You know, there is a lot of weirdness in that particular part of Wisconsin, what they call the Driftless region, the area not crushed by the glacier. And yeah, there's cults and there's just an unusual number of unsolved crimes. And then you have Devil's Lake, where you have 1970s cultists contacting what, to be blunt, sound very much like the same spirits that the Native Americans have been in contact with for thousands of years earlier. And I mean, it's really very similar. And that H.P. Lovecraft's friend and the person who carried on his work, August Derleth, moves of all places in the world to right by Devil's Lake to set up the Arkham House Publishing. And I mean, that's with no insult intended, that's the middle of nowhere. That's not the center of anything. I mean, anything normal, okay? It's like you're in this little county that's just, you know, it's very rural Wisconsin. And this is where you set up a publishing house for Lovecraft material that still exists to this day. And I mean, in his book, Kenneth Grant spelled out that Derleth believed that there were real Lovecraftian entities in Devil's Lake. And the native people had believed that there was a portal to the underworld at the bottom of the lake. So, I mean, yeah, that synchronizes quite well. It's absolutely bizarre.
Yeah, it was really trippy for me as well. I mean, certainly too, because I think, I'm not 100% on this, but I think the area around Somerset, Nathan thought that they were doing the bait cabal was during their rituals was around that one lake that's a little south of Somerset that's really popular with the tourists. Gosh, I can't remember what it's called now.
Lake Cumberland.
Yeah. I think that was like the area. And then, of course, as I had mentioned in the opening monologue, there's Lake Colby in Lake Colby Park, Ranger Casadega. And, of course, that's kind of tied into the whole Lovecraft thing, too, because Lovecraft used to visit his literary, what became his literary executioner, R.H. Barlow in DeLand, Florida, which is right next to Casadega. So, it's kind of another strange thing. I know, Vincent, you and I had talked about like the reoccurrence of amphibious beings and what have you and all this. So yeah, I don't know, folks. Lakes keep coming up in all this crap. I don't know why. They're there though. Let's just leave it at that.
Well, if I might just add on a little bit, with some involvement with other people, somehow the Driftless region of Wisconsin has like spiked this year without any intention of, like, on my part anyway, or anybody I know of trying to make that happen. It just seems to have happened, and all these people are having experiences and discussing them publicly in this really rural, you know, almost depopulated part of Wisconsin. It's like something there wants to be heard. So make of that what you will.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. And another note too, I mean, that, you know, just my kind of a recent time in Milwaukee, I mean, it was almost sort of a bit of like, for me, an almost Somerset-like experience, but a bigger version of Somerset. But I mean, yeah, it's kind of a similar vibe. It seems like, you know, you've got a lot of the, even in kind of a bigger city like that, you have kind of a lot of the kind of colorful characters that Somerset has, such as yourself or David Barsky from Weeping Spiders, welcome. And yeah, so I'm definitely excited to get back out there in the spring and check out Devil's Lake this time around. I'm curious to see if it's even more Somerset-esque. But yeah, it's kind of interesting how it does seem to there is sort of an overlap with some of the communities in both from what I've seen so far. It's another oddity in all of this. All right. We are living in weird times. There's no question. Even the public state is being forced to acknowledge this, hence the tiresome UFO disclosure. But this stuff is so underwhelming in comparison to what's happening on the fringes. Jason, you and I talked about how forgettable UFO experiences can be when I was on Paranormal Patio. In comparison, we're seeing so much crazy stuff on the fringes, especially online nowadays. A lot of things like the Lovecraft Gnosis, mysticism, Discordianism, hyperstition, Neoism, the DAKMU, and so forth, have produced some curious offspring. You're seeing it manifest in things like time sorcery, reality shifting, the Saturnine Current, Randonautica, and all these insane alternate reality games that have cropped up over the last decade or so. Actually, there's a really crazy one from Wisconsin. What is it? Weird Wisconsin. Or no, this is my Milwaukee. You should check that out, Vincent. Because, of course, it would also have its own insane alternate reality game. I'm going to do a show on that, actually, in a couple of weeks, kids. So don't worry. You're going to get more Weird Wisconsin with that one. Anyway, it is my opinion that a lot of these things are triggering a climate the likes of which we in the West have not experienced in a long time. It's happening to a lot of people in curious ways. Horrific dreams, bizarre and incredible synchronicities, the Mandela effect, the normalization of high weirdness. It's hardly any wonder much of the public is yawning at the UFO disclosure narrative in comparison to their day-to-day lives now. I mean, gosh, we were just talking about, you know, what 2019 was like, Vincent. Like I said, that was, you know, that wasn't uncommon for some people. All right, so is this the sense that you guys are getting as well? Why don't you start us off, Vincent?
Oh, absolutely. I feel, and this is, you know, just my impression, that the veil is ripping, that it's being, by the veil, I mean, the difference between the mundane, normal, day-to-day consensus reality and the weird things that people experience once in a while is really getting pushed to the limit and is starting to break apart. That what has been abnormal, what has been questionable, whether it was even real at all, may come spilling out into the public at any moment, is how I feel. I'm kind of reminded of the movie Signs, where the first time you see one of the creatures walking on CNN, I really feel like that's what we're kind of poised for. Now, it may not happen like that. It may be more gradual, but it really seems that already we're accepting a much higher level of paranormal, or whatever you want to call it, not the average experience, on a regular basis. And that's, it is really becoming normalized, and it's changing our society. And like 10 years ago, I knew exactly two older ladies who were acknowledged witches. Now I know so many witches, I couldn't even give you an exact number. And these things are just, they are exploding.
Yeah, and no, I just was thinking, you know, now that like the what is it, hedge witch, that's like now like a common term. I mean, I heard that like 2 years ago, and I was like, what the fuck is a hedge witch, man?
Right. You're not alone.
Yep.
But yeah, that it's changes are drastic and in unpredictable directions.
You know, I think that, to backtrack, I'm a big subscriber to manifestation reality. You know, our thoughts and our experiences create our reality. And because of the attention that strangeness has been getting the last, let's just even narrow down to the last decade, but you could go back further with the popularity in media, you know, with the ghost hunting shows that started in the early 2000s. And then, of course, we had paranormal shows, you know, before then, but like the ghost hunters on Sci-Fi really seemed to, I don't know, bring about this new eon of paranormal TV and things. I think there are enough people that are thinking about this stuff now that it is manifesting into our reality. And I don't know if that does anything to how genuine these experiences are. I mean, if you're dealing with the manifestation of an egregore, I mean, is that a genuine experience, or is that something altogether different? I don't want to get too deep in philosophical conversation about, you know, a UFO showing up on CNN, but I think that we're going to see more as long as this keeps growing the way that it's growing. And all of us are responsible for that, just as well as anyone else at this point. We just keep feeding the egregore, right? But I'm excited about it, but I also am really, I'm really worried about it, because the manipulation of mainstream media and political governments that want to frame these as existential threats, these UFO sightings, you know, there, it's no coincidence that they're releasing video captured by military cameras and not people in Wyoming. You know what I mean? I worry that it's going to be framed as these are dangerous beings from somewhere else with technology we have no capability of understanding, and they're going to destroy us all. You better hurry up and buy some more toilet paper and bottled water, yada, yada, yada. And I don't think that's the case, because the history of sightings of UFOs, you know, if they were coming to get us, we'd be gone. Like, we wouldn't be waiting 3,000 years for a flaming chariot to, you know, strike us down with fiery arrows. Like, we would already be gone. They're not coming to destroy us or to resource harvest our planet. That's just not the case. And I hope that enough people are smart enough to not buy into that fear that I definitely see coming down the pike.
I can tell you, I share your concerns. Prior to COVID, I was a very pro-disclosure. I was pissed. I want the government to tell us everything they know right now. We're American people. We deserve the truth. Tell us, show us the bodies, show us the ships. You know, after COVID and after being on Facebook, and I stay in some Facebook groups that I don't agree with just to hear what they're saying, and like half the country would think they're demons. And it would just, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen with that. There's so much positive going on now, but there's also a hell of a lot of negative. And I mean, Putin's got some mystic pulling his strings. And I'm sure that's not unique to Russia. Okay, that's all over the world. And there's just a lot of people who are seeing this change that is taking place, but they're seeing it through a super narrow fundamentalist religious structure, and everything's demons. To go to a certain group and Bigfoot's a demon, ghosts are demons.
It's interesting too when you sort of look even at like the developments in Christianity really since the 70s. I think especially with the rise of dominionism, this is something, you know, I had the great religious scholar Andre Gagne on that we talked about, but you know, as Andre, I kind of got him to sort of tentatively acknowledge, I mean, dominionism in a lot of ways, I mean, it's almost the reverse side of the coin of like the New Age movement, which kind of rose concurrently with it, because it does really possess very much a magical worldview, and it even has its own sort of mysticism in it. I mean, especially with the whole process of binding and casting out demons and all this kind of stuff. I mean, it really is, I mean, full-blown magical rites that they're working with. I mean, they obviously would never acknowledge them as such, but I mean, it was a fundamental break with the direction of, you know, at the time, a lot of mainline Protestant churches and so forth, which had become increasingly secular, frankly, in the 20th century. Whereas I think that in the currents of, you know, what was originally fringe Christianity, which is increasingly taking over the mainstream, you know, you did have this magical worldview that prevailed, in which you saw the modern world awash with angels and demons and all of these other supernatural entities that had to be either appeased or destroyed, so to speak. So yeah, I mean, that's I think another factor that's not really kind of acknowledged, but I mean, it was this sort of warped, you know, reverse version of what was concurrently happening with the New Age movement at the same time. And when you do sort of factor in a lot of the stuff that was also happening, again, with the military, I talked a bit about Barlow and his ties to anthropology and the Rockefeller Foundation. I mean, the Rockefellers spent a fortune going into, you know, the social sciences during the 50s and 60s. And then, I mean, certainly beginning in the 60s and 70s, the Pentagon was just pumping millions and millions of dollars into this kind of research. And it was looking at odd things. What was it? The Special Operations Research Organization, for instance, which is sort of the research foundation for an early incarnation of the Army Special Operations Command, was researching magic and witchcraft in the Congo, for instance. I mean, they produced a huge report on all of this and how essentially magic could be used as a manipulation of indigenous superstitions and what have you. I mean, this was stuff that was getting a lot of money from the military to be looked at. But again, when you sort of consider the guy who was overseeing a lot of this stuff in the late 1950s and the 1960s, there was an office in the Pentagon known as the Office of Special Operations, and it was overseen by the assistant director, or was it the assistant to the Secretary of Defense for the Office of Special Operations, one of those glorious Pentagon titles that bit of a tongue twister. But anyway, this was kind of a proto version of the Special Operations Command. And the de facto head, he became the official head in 61, I think, but he was more or less running the outfit by 57, 58, was good old General Edward Lansdale. He of the glorious counterinsurgency operations in the 1950s, in which insurgents were drained of blood and hung in trees so that the Hook rebels would think that they were killed by vampires. Where they would fly around with helicopters and broadcast the names of insurgents down to make them think that their dead relatives were doing it. And they actually later did that in Vietnam. It was called Operation Wandering Souls. A guy called Michael Aquino participated in that one. But Lansdale, he was a big believer in using occult superstitions and humor. In fact, he actually did lectures on this at Army war colleges, and it was later incorporated into Army psychological warfare manuals, the importance of practical jokes in psychological operations. This was the guy who was running this early incarnation of the SOCOM during the late 50s and 1960s when they were sponsoring a lot of this insane research. So when you factor in a lot of this, it makes a lot more sense when you think about the career of a guy like Colonel Michael Aquino, to put it mildly. In a lot of ways, he was just kind of tearing on the tradition of a guy like Lansdale, but I digress. But yeah, I mean, Aquino was a guy certainly also with his whole concept of mind war, where, I mean, you do sort of get a sense of this reality creation or co-creation as well. And I mean, this is kind of another factor that I think is playing out in all of this, is how are the intelligence services, I mean, manipulating this? I mean, you know, they've spent God knows how much money studying through anthropology and other social sciences how superstitions and occultism can be used to manipulate and control populations. I seriously doubt that it hadn't occurred to somebody beyond Michael Aquino that, I mean, you could go beyond that to potentially use some of these methods to shape reality. And I mean, how is this playing into a lot of the things that are happening now as well? I mean, I know this might seem kind of woo-woo to a lot of people listening to this, but again, you know, you've got to go back to like things like the 2016 election and the freaking meme wars and all this other kind of stuff that we were seeing back then. You know, I mean, this stuff was not happening in a bubble. There were some, let's just say there were some people in the backdrop of this with some serious connections to private military companies, private intelligence companies. And certainly, I mean, the Army itself had been studying memetics for the purposes of warfare, along with, or I should say, the, what was it, the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects or whatever, the intelligence community's version of DARPA was studying alternate reality games for the same purposes around 2012, 2013. And then suddenly you start seeing a lot of this kind of crazy stuff playing out around the 2016 election. So, hey, again, you know, I mean, these are things that have to be considered. There are a lot of state actors who are aware of this kind of stuff. Or I should say former state actors who are now working in a private capacity, rather, who are aware of this kind of stuff. And, you know, they're using it for their own ends as well. It is a very much a battle, not just for the hearts and minds, but I think the spirits and souls right now as well.
Yeah, agreed.
Yes, I actually know an older man who was in Vietnam where they were instructed to mutilate the enemy dead to convince them that they to convince the populace that they could destroy their souls, playing upon their belief systems. And as you put it, that they studied this in the Congo and they studied it in Vietnam and they studied it in Korea, but we didn't really consider they're studying us too. And they'd use it at home. And next thing you know, Pepe the Frog is like a big deal instead of just some nonsense cartoon. And yeah, they're willing to do.
Well, you know, it goes even deeper than that, Vince, because you got to remember too, another one of Lansdale's great innovations in the Philippines, we didn't invent it. He claimed that he invented it, but he didn't. But it was a glorious thing known as civil action, which is also the third component of the Army Special Operations Command, along with the operators themselves and the psychological warfare unit. So what is civil action? Well, civil action was originally conceived as hearts and minds stuff. You would send troops out to help rebuild bridges and stuff like that. But Lansdell saw that it could be so much more. You could also use it for the purposes of psychological warfare. You could use it to spy on domestic populaces. You could use it to herd them into strategic hamlets where they could be monitored in the purposes of land and agrarian reform. And in the case of the Philippines, he found out that you could take a lot of military veterans, put them into these civil action units, and use them to campaign for a populist candidate and get him elected to the presidency. Gosh, isn't that kind of funny?
It makes you wonder, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I know we're short on time, but you've heard of Smedley Butler, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And when he was approached by a group of very anti-Roosevelt, anti-New Deal millionaires who wanted him to lead the American Legion, the same American Legion that exists today, as a form of like the brown shirts or the black shirts, and, you know, a political militia, and by violence force Roosevelt into a powerless position, and Wall Street would appoint the de facto president they wanted. Well, Smedley Butler actually believed in democracy and reported them immediately, and nobody suffered any real consequences for an attempted coup. But is there an echo in here? Yeah, you know, it seems to have things like that are happening again. And yeah, it just like that. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it is another component of all the insanity that is going on the current era that we are living in, that is for sure. All right, guys. Well, I think it's been a great conversation here. Hope all you guys have enjoyed it as much as we have. And again, thank you to all you subscribers out there. And as always, good night and good luck to you all.